NASA made a major announcement. It picked two private companies to build spaceships for taking astronauts to the International Space Station. NASA hopes that both models will eventually be used by space tourists to get into orbit, which got us wondering, which one would we want to fly in? NPR's Jeff Brumfield has some advice on what to think about when choosing your next spaceship.
Capsule One is called Dragon. It's built by the sexy California startup SpaceX.
It's all around, I think, really a big leap forward in technology. It really takes things to the next level.
That was SpaceX founder Elon Musk unveiling the Dragon earlier this summer at a promotional event that could have been for a new smartphone. Then there's capsule number two. Its name isn't quite as good. It's called the CST-100, and it's built by the Ford of space companies, Boeing.
Boeing's been in this business for 50 years. We've been building spacecraft. But I think we have really pulled together a world-class spacecraft that has benefited from the ones that have come before it.
Actually, the spaceships look a lot alike. They're both white. They're both shaped kind of like gumdrops. Keith Cowing runs the blog NASA Watch.
Well, both of them are offering sort of the same thing. It's a capsule that can carry seven people. It's launched on a commercial rocket. It takes off in Florida, and it goes to the International Space Station.
They both have very little legroom. Initially, at least, both will use parachutes to land. And if those fail?
The inside of the spacecraft is designed to crumple like a good car. It's designed to actually absorb the shock.
So, standard safety features. But if you think about it, cars have a lot of standard features. Airbags, radios.
If you look at a Cadillac or a Lexus or a Lamborghini, you know, all those basic functions are available on every vehicle.
That's former astronaut Clay Anderson. He's flown the space shuttle and the Russian Soyuz, so I asked him how to choose a spaceship.
It's when you get down to the quote-unquote creature comforts. Those are the things that will stand out to me.
For example, there's a lot of waiting around before your spaceship actually launches.
As you lie on your back on the launch pad, it'd be lovely to have, some nice Muzak.
T-minus 10 minutes to liftoff. Seriously, though, Anderson says there is something that would make a big difference. The control panels on the old space shuttle were a nightmare to read. In the era of tablet computers, he wants spaceships to be more user-friendly.
Touch screens, nice bright colors, reds that indicate emergencies, yellows indicate cautions, greens indicate AOKs, that sort of thing.
Boeing and SpaceX both have new displays standard on every model, but Keith Cowing says there is a difference.
The Boeing one does harken back to Apollo. It does have a bit of that look, and I've actually been in Apollo capsules. The SpaceX one, I've been in there, and it's got a sci-fi vibe to it.
SpaceX is sleeker, and it'd be his first choice, but honestly, he'd fly in either one if it meant he got to go to space. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
The latest big retailer to suffer a cyber attack is Home Depot. The big box home repair store says some 56 million cardholders were possibly compromised in a cyber attack. It's the latest in a string of data breaches, and as NPR's Sonari Glinton reports, it is not likely to be the last.
Home Depot's data breach was first reported at the beginning of this month by Brian Krebs on his blog. He's the go-to guy for this kind of stuff, so he's going to help me explain how the Home Depot hack went down. It starts the moment you swipe your credit or debit card to complete a purchase.
There's this moment where the information gets transferred from the little terminal that you use to swipe your card. That is separate and apart from the cash register itself, which is essentially a Windows computer.
Krebs says the information, in this case, sits around for a leisurely fraction of a second or so, and then...
And then it gets handed off to the cash register, and that's where the malware is designed to sit. That's where that malicious software lies in wait.
And before it gets encrypted and shipped to the bank and other destinations unknown, the hacker siphon off the valuable information. Home Depot said in a statement that there was no evidence that debit PIN numbers were compromised or that the breach affected online shoppers. Krebs has some important advice for consumers, so pay attention. It'll go by quickly.
Number one, it's important not to freak out about this.
Now, don't freak out, and...
I always tell people, if you have a choice, don't shop with your debit card.
Krebs is alluding to special protections the law gives to those shopping with credit cards rather than debit cards. So how long are we going to keep hearing about big retail hacks like this?
We're going to be dealing with this problem of small to medium-sized and large retailers experiencing this very same type of breach for at least the next year, probably more like 2 or 3 years.
That's all I got for an ending.
I get to have the last word, do I?
Sonari Glinton, NPR News.
Alibaba, the Chinese e-commerce company, made history yesterday with the largest U.S. IPO ever. Shares climbed 38% on the first day of trading. Now, one company is riding nicely along with Alibaba, Yahoo. A decade ago, Yahoo quietly made a $1 billion bet on Alibaba, and that wager's turned into a windfall of at least $8 billion, one of the best moves in Yahoo's up-and-down history. NPR's Aarti Shahani has the story.
It was August 2005, August 11th to be exact, and to those who were watching, Yahoo's move didn't seem so masterful.
At that moment, when you first looked at it, it was, wow, I wonder if Yahoo knows what it's doing.
F. Warren McFarlane is a professor at the Harvard Business School.
And the answer is they knew partly what they were doing, and there were other pieces of it that they just didn't understand.
McFarlane, who has written about Chinese tech companies for decades, found it curious when the founder of Yahoo, a fellow American named Jerry Yang, came to town. Yang was in search of a native Chinese company to help Yahoo build its web searching business there, someone to deliver contacts and customers and deal with the government. Yang was not betting on the success of that native company when he handed over a check for $1 billion.
It wasn't so clear how he was going to get the return out of it.
Internet companies are, in essence, information companies, and McFarlane says the Chinese government was heavy-handed about controlling information, so it wasn't clear that startups could prosper. But he doesn't want to overstate how much attention the deal got.
In the big picture around the world, it was a much more of a yawn.
Or a subplot. The much bigger story was another American giant, eBay, trying to stomp out Alibaba, the scrappy Chinese startup. Many assumed it would be an easy knockout for eBay, but it wasn't. And Yahoo became a pawn in that fight, as business reporters like CNBC's Maria Bartiromo told the story.
eBay obviously has been trying to really build and be a successful company in China. I guess with the Yahoo backing, this is really representing a big challenge for eBay in China.
Alibaba did win decisively, snagging millions of Chinese consumers to its online auction site. And now Yahoo gets to cash in. The company based in Sunnyvale, California, is selling about one quarter of its shares and getting billions of dollars back in return. Yahoo wouldn't tell NPR exactly how it plans to spend all that money, whether it'll give it out in payments to investors or buy many more startups. But for Colin Gillis, an analyst with BGC Partners, one thing is clear.
It's not their hard work that generated this return. It's Alibaba's success that generated this return.
There also may be a downside for Yahoo. For years, U.S. investors couldn't buy a single share of Alibaba directly, so they had to invest in Yahoo as a proxy. Now with Alibaba on the New York Stock Exchange, investors could dump their Yahoo stock. Gillis sums up the question on Wall Street.
Why would I want to buy the proxy now that I can buy the real thing?
No matter how you size up the long-term prospects, Yahoo right now gets a lot of cash on hand. While Silicon Valley companies from Google to Microsoft to Cisco have a long history of investing in other startups, the sheer size of the payoff from Yahoo's bet is unique. As Cisco Chief Strategy Officer Padma Warrior puts it,
it is not common that every investment, you know, goes in the tens of billions of dollars.
Her company and others are crisscrossing the world in search of their Alibaba. And Warrior says in the last decade, the conventional wisdom about why you invest abroad has changed.
It's no longer the case that you can develop a product for US or Europe and then take features away and, you know, in a way dumb down the product to take into an emerging market. I think that's turned out to be a myth.
The new wisdom, and certainly a lesson gleaned from Yahoo's foray into China, is that native companies know what their people want and how to deliver it, and Silicon Valley can tag along for the ride. Aarti Shahani, NPR News, San Francisco.
In San Diego earlier this week, about 24 people gathered for a 2-day boot camp. There was no physical exertion. They were training their brains to make sense of the world of data patterns and algorithms at the University of California, San Diego's Data Mining Boot Camp. Natasha Baylock leads the program, and she says it's attracting all kinds of professionals.
We have a variety of people taking these boot camps. We have people from IT and utilities to people from HR and computational science or casinos and anything in between, really.
Now, we'll try to skip past the technicalities of algorithms and or how predictive analysis works. Can you just tell us, what do people leave this boot camp being able to do with their skills?
They're able to take a data set that they might be doing in their professional or personal life and apply these algorithms to find patterns, rules, associations, or some unexpected insight from the data.
So if someone, say, comes in who's a HR specialist, what could they come out of this knowing how to do?
They might be able to look at their data and find how to make unhappy employees happier. Not everybody is interested in a higher salary. Some people really value extra 3 days of vacation a year. And you can take the data you have of the behavior of the previous employees and the current employees and be able to find this kind of insight to take proactive actions before your employees or your customers get upset. And it really is everywhere. Looking for patterns in large amounts of data and then being able to find insight that you can take some action on really happens everywhere. If you check your Facebook page and you look at the news feed, there's predictive analytics behind it. Facebook uses these algorithms to try and find the news you personally would be most interested in. So they will look at your close group of friends and family. They will look at what kinds of news did you click on before. Most marketing companies will use them. All the pop-ups you have in your browsers when you're searching are based on your previous behavior. If you go to your local grocery store, the coupons that you get will be targeted specifically for you.
Has it got to the point now that if you're running a business, you need to either have command of data mining and predictive analytics or have somebody on staff who's a specialist?
It's starting to be that way. I think that predictive analytics or data science will become a department of its own, and many organizations already are creating those. It is going to be something every organization is going to need as much as they need IT.
And is that why you've started this school, and are there other schools like yours?
Absolutely, yes. I have actually been teaching a data mining certificate program for about 12 years. 12 years ago, we had to cancel classes because we wouldn't have more than 5 students. We now have two sections of 60 plus. We're starting a master's program at UCSD. Some people really don't want certificates or degrees. They really just want to learn practical hands-on how to apply these techniques. And that's really what prompted these two-day boot camps.
A couple of years ago, the Harvard Business Review called the data scientist the sexiest job of the 21st century. Why is it so hot?
Because there is not enough people to do the job, and because the job is really turning into a very interesting, creative, and cool job. Data scientists need to have several different types of skills. You need to have those technical skills, machine learning, and statistics to be able to manipulate the data and find those patterns. But that's just not enough. In order to be a successful data scientist, you need to understand the business, ask the right questions, be able to be creative of how you treat your data in order to find those patterns. And this is why it's so difficult to find people who can do that job.
Natasha Baylock is the director of the Predictive Analytics Center of Excellence at the University of California, San Diego. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
A heated debate in the video game industry has turned ugly and has escalated to include death threats. It's known as Gamergate. And it's gotten so bad that two women have left their homes because of online threats. And another woman, an award-winning games journalist, has said she will never report on the industry again. It's a complicated debate about many parts of a changing industry. NPR's Nathan Rott reports.
Let's start with the basics. Gamergate started as a hashtag on Twitter, a banner under which people could collectively argue, vent, or attack an idea or an individual. In Gamergate's case, that individual was Zoe Quinn.
I'm Zoe Quinn, and I'm an independent game developer and community organizer.
Quinn has been actively involved in the video game industry for a while, and she's part of a growing demographic in that industry, developers and designers who aren't making the next Call of Duty or big-budget role-playing game.
I basically make weird little games that are about feelings, so not the traditional sort of game where people usually think of when you say video game.
Quinn's most notable game is called Depression Quest, a game that simulates the experience of having depression through multiple-choice text. And Quinn, unwillingly sparked the Gamergate debate. A few weeks ago, a spiteful ex-boyfriend accused her online of sleeping with a game's journalist, implying it garnered her better coverage for Depression Quest, a charge Quinn denies. What followed, though, was Gamergate, a huge backlash of people taking to Twitter, YouTube, and online forums, many using the allegations against Quinn as proof that there's ethical corruption in video games journalism, that game developers and game journalists have grown too cozy. Others labeled Quinn as a so-called social justice warrior, a woman who isn't interested in games, just in promoting herself and her ideals by challenging video games' traditionally male-dominated culture. And that's where things got ugly. Horribly ugly. Quinn was flooded with death threats. Rape threats. Her personal information, even photos, were hacked and posted online, forcing her to leave her home.
It's like the internet is eager and waiting for a reason to be a total scumbag to you, at least if you're a woman and you're a loud, outspoken woman.
Quinn says she was surprised by the vitriol, and she wasn't.
It's happened to other women in the industry. Like, Anita Sarkeesian has been basically living this for the last 2 years.
Anita Sarkeesian is a video game critic who looks at the way the video game industry portrays women in games. In video blogs, she talks about the roles women characters play, the damsel in distress, the goal to be achieved, or darker roles.
How sexualized female bodies often occupy a dual role as both sexual playthings and the perpetual victims of male violence.
Are you here for the whore?
In the last few weeks, with Gamergate going, the backlash against Sarkeesian's critiques got so bad, she had to leave her home too.
It can turn your stomach pretty quick.
That's Adam Saltzman. Saltzman runs a small game company in Texas with his wife. They both watched appalled as the backlash spread from Quinn and Sarkeesian to other women and men in the industry who offered their support to the two women. Now, Saltzman believes the attackers were and are emboldened by the anonymity of Twitter and online forums like Reddit and 4chan. And he says they're not representative of the gaming community overall.
The people doing the most harm are absolutely a vocal minority.
But their attack still worked. In an email from Germany, independent games designer Andreas Zecker says they caused a, quote, brief but unbearable silence because people were afraid of becoming the next target. To show solidarity, Zecker wrote an open letter decrying the harassment and saying that everyone, regardless of gender, has the right to be a part of the video game industry. The letter gained nearly 2,500 signatures, many from prominent names at AAA game studios like Rockstar North, Naughty Dog, Bungie, and Ubisoft. There's still a question, though, of just why or how a handful of allegations at a small games developer could spark such a huge firestorm in a multi-billion dollar industry. Lee Alexander is a video games journalist based in the UK.
What I think's going on is that there's a cultural spasm happening that nobody expected that accompanies the sort of mainstreaming of video games and the diversification of video games.
Alexander is talking about games like Candy Crush or Words with Friends, games that are now on smartphones and tablets, accessible to a far wider range of people. Not, she says, the traditional boys' club.
And, you know, I think the conventional audience is really shaken up. I think in part because they're sexist, in part because they're used to, you know, being explicitly catered to as a precious special market demographic. And they feel like they might get left behind.
Alexander's is just one of many theories, but most agree the industry is changing. The question is whether that change can happen in a more civil way. Nathan Rott, NPR News.
Google, Facebook, Twitter, many of the most popular services on the internet are free of charge. But we do pay for them. We pay with our personal data. These companies gather as much information as they can about us, and they sort it, dissect it, and study it. And they use their knowledge about us to target us with advertising. In recent weeks on AllTech, we've heard differing opinions about this dominant internet business model. Some, like Omri Ben-Shahar, a law professor at the University of Chicago, defend it as a bargain.
For many people, the bargain is a great bargain. They don't really care that much about the hypothetical dignitary effect of having their information stored by someone. And at the same time, they like very much that they don't have to pay.
And we've heard an apology from a tech guru who had a hand in creating this business model. Ethan Zuckerman wrote the code for the original pop-up ad.
If you want to start a new advertising-based web business, you have to somehow demonstrate you're going to find out even more about your user than Facebook does.
Zuckerman, who's now at MIT, has some regrets.
And we need some combination of new business models and probably a certain amount of regulation to protect our online behavior and identities to really get us out of what looks like an increasingly complicated trap.
Well, we're going to hear now about some new businesses that are trying to do things differently. They're trying to capitalize on privacy as a selling point. Steve Henn of NPR's Planet Money team joins us now. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Steve, as Ethan Zuckerman says, free is hard to compete with, but I gather you say there are some alternatives to the pay-with-your-data model out there.
Well, we're beginning to see some crop up. One is called Open Whisper Systems. This is a nonprofit company started by a hacker who goes by the name Moxie Marlinspike, and it's building open source encryption tools for messaging and phone calls. What's interesting about what Open Whisper Systems is doing is that they're giving the code away to other companies for free, and they already have millions of adopters. There are also for-profit businesses that are betting that security and privacy will sell. Silent Circle offers a fee-based text messaging system. There's a company that makes something called the Black Phone, which is a secure Android phone. And Wickr, which offers more secure-based text messaging and the ability to delete and wipe old messages. All of these businesses have been able to raise money from large investors, including some prominent ones.
So there are investors, but does investment translate into consumers?
Well, you know, that's interesting, and there hasn't been a big consumer market for privacy in the past. But that may be beginning to change. And what all of the businesses I just mentioned are doing, they're targeting people who handle lots of sensitive information, Wall Street bankers, executives. And I think that generally people who have very sensitive information are more receptive to the pitch that privacy and security are worth paying for. But what I think is really fascinating is how this attitude is beginning to trickle into the consumer market. Here's Tim Cook speaking on Charlie Rose a couple weeks ago. Cook, of course, is Apple's CEO.
We try not to collect data. So we're not reading your email. We're not reading your iMessage. If the government laid a subpoena on us to get your iMessages, we can't provide it. It's encrypted and we don't have the key.
So the challenge to companies out there is to make the consumers value that security, that privacy so much that they'll be willing to pay for it.
Right. And this is actually a pitch to consumers that Apple is making aggressively right now. A week after Tim Cook spoke on Charlie Rose, Apple announced that its new operating system for iPhones and iPads would encrypt all the data on your phone or device at rest. So if police or someone else served Apple with a warrant to open a locked phone, they wouldn't be able to get anything off it. Now, security researchers I've spoken to have pointed out that Apple actually does have public keys for iMessages, and theoretically at least, it could decrypt those messages. Apple denies it does that, but others have found ways to get data off locked iPhones. Still, the thing is, Apple systems are really getting better, and the company is aggressively competing on privacy. And it's forcing other companies to compete as well. Just a few hours after Apple made its announcement about encrypting data on phones, Google's Android said it would do the same thing. So Google is apparently worried people will choose other products based on privacy, which is interesting. When Google competes on privacy, you know something's changed.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
That's Steve Henn of NPR's Planet Money team.